talked about the 3G as defined by 3GPP, the third generation parking design. Now, the idea of the third generation, as we saw, was that we were going to take advantage of the much higher data rates that we could get by using more complex signal processing in the communication channel. And so one of the goals was really to offer higher rates than ISDN, typically thought to be higher than 384 kilobits per second, and perhaps up to 2 megabits per second when you were near a base station and conditions were good. And in particular, by moving to much higher data rates, it was expected that, of course, you could support things like interactive multimedia, like video conferencing. Now, I grew up near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which in the 1950s had, yes, picture telephony. It was an utter, total failure. That hasn't stopped the telecom world from wanting to have picture telephony since the 1950s. Okay, and one of the hard problems is it the other person you want to see, or do you want to see what the other person can see? And so today there's a major argument that it isn't about just seeing talking heads. It's about being able to have a shared visual experience where we could discuss the design of this thing, and you could see what I could see, and potentially, in many cases, you could see things from many perspectives. So you want to watch the football match, and you want to say, I want to see the perspective from the point of view of the ball. Or, I want to see it from the perspective of this goalpost, or this position. And increasingly, of course, today, because of video coding, these systems are increasingly model-driven. So there's actually a model of the whole stadium, a model of the ball, and all we're doing is passing around parameters, which then are used by the graphics engine to synthesize the point of view from the perspective that you want. Okay, so it isn't just about moving pixels anymore, it's about sending around model parameters. And that radically changes things. I believe that maybe video conferencing will start to become very interesting. But the other thing that happened unexpectedly is the fact that cameras got very inexpensive. So equipping a phone with a 2 or 5 or 7 or whatever megapixel camera isn't a big problem. So an interesting thing that we see is a reversal of the usual situation where instead of users just consuming multimedia, users are generating multimedia. Okay? So the user pulls out their phone, points it at something, and starts filming. They want to uplink that to somewhere else so that other people can see what they can see, the sort of iNews reporting sorts of things. And that means we need to have enough bandwidth coming from the mobile device to actually be able to send this data back in while it's still valuable to other people who want to see it. Yesterday, Aurelien Barilla presented his doctoral dissertation on something called DVB-H, Digital Video Broadcast-Handheld. And in particular, he looked at the combination between DVB-H, which is broadcast out using the main broadcasting towers, supplemented by sending the extra data that you need over the cellular network. And the problem is that this broadcast digital video for handheld devices has a difficulty because unlike the digital video broadcast terrestrial, which is received by rooftop antennas, which are nice big antennas pointed towards the big broadcasting tower, the little handheld device doesn't have a big antenna. Right? So the signal power is much lower, and therefore the problem is either you can only receive it if you're very close to the antenna, or even worse, you may only receive some of it because as vehicles and other things move around, you're going to lose some of the bits. So the technique that Aurelien introduced is to say, well, let me get the extra bits via a high-speed network. And I only need to get some of them, but I need to get them fast because, remember, it's video. And suddenly, I get better coverage. So I can provide this digital video over a much larger surface area than I can from the main antenna mast. So there's interesting questions and battles today over whether it's going to be digital video broadcast dash H for handheld, or is it going to be cell-based broadcast, which is another 3G technique that's being positioned to compete against basically broadcast television. Right? Because the problem is, as all of you know, analog broadcasting was turned off in Sweden, and it's being turned off in many countries. And so the problem is that means there's a whole new infrastructure. There have to be not another set of receivers. So the analog broadcast industry lost their momentum, right? So potentially other people can come along and say, hey, why do you need to have this broadcast TV? Your phone is ringing here. Yes. The net result is suddenly all of these customers have an alternative. They can think about getting it via a different communication system. And lots of people will vote with their feet and with their dollars and euros and krona and so forth and choose other systems. And with increasingly large amounts of storage in handhelds, today gigabyte is not uncommon. Within a few years, we'll have terabyte stores in our handsets. It means I don't need to stream the data anymore. I can burst the data in. So when you have good conditions, we send you lots of data. When you move to this position that has poor coverage, okay, you may not be able to get as much data. You might not even be able to get any data. But as long as your cache has plenty of data, there's no problem, right? Because I listen to the content out of the cache. Medium data rate activities like web browsing, activities like fax, they're persistent. Speech, telephony systems, and messaging, email, SMS, etc. Now, all of this is based on CDMA. In particular, Europe's take on UMTS would be wideband CDMA. If you actually look at the UMTS documentation, you'll see that they actually considered five different standards to be able to support UMTS. But ETSI basically agreed on, okay, here's the scheme we're going to use, in particular, wideband CDMA. Okay. So we said this is driven by this third generation partnership project, which was basically a combination of people wanting to promote the successor to GSM. And because they were trying to build on the success of GSM and the packet GPRS service that was introduced and the enhanced data rates of Edge, a difficulty was how do we manage to make it so that we incrementally update the system? Right? Because the hard problem is if you're an operator, you don't want to replace everything and tell all of your customers, like, sorry, none of your handsets work, you have to buy all new handsets. Right? The solution has to be, how can I make incremental adjustments so that I keep everybody using my systems, right, if I'm an operator? ETSI, the GPP Secretariat, and one of the very wise things that they have done now is you can actually get the documents for free. A complete change from the normal ITU model where you had to pay for the documents, which meant, of course, almost no one ever read them. They just wrote them. So this picture, and no one's going into panic yet, shows the 3GPP architecture, okay? And what we recognize immediately is there's something that changed out here, okay? We don't have BTSs. We now have something called Node B. They have a different interface to a radio net controller, not a base station controller anymore, but a radio net controller. We still see the SGSN, the GGSN. We see now the HLR, VLR, the authentication center. We see the MSC. We see the gateway MSCs. But there are a couple of interesting surprises here. One is we see something now labeled HSS. And HSS subsumes what previously was the HLR, VLR, and AUC all into one logical entity. And this was viewed as being very important because it improved the scalability by now having a distributed HSS. You could say, aha, it's a logical entity, but we can distribute it all around our network to scale as we want. There's also an introduction of a new system called IMS, the IP multimedia system, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. And what we'll notice is this whole structure up here is part of the core network, and it's all circuit switched, and this part down here is all part also of the core network, but it's packet switched. And one of the things that we see is that basically this part up here that was circuit switched is going away. So everything is now being tied to this core packet switch network, including even the gateway to the PSTN. And we'll see how the IMS does that in a little bit. But basically, you can look at this and immediately recognize almost all the features that you've seen before. Not surprising, since it's an evolution. Now, of course, if 3G was a good idea, well, 3.5G, an even better idea. And so one of the important things that was introduced was, okay, now how do we upgrade the 3G network? Now that we've installed this new radio network, and one of the important things was the introduction of so-called high-speed downlink packet access and high-speed uplink packet access, sometimes called 3G or Super 3G. And here the goal was to say, well, when the user's in a good position and they want a lot of data, give them a very high data rate channel. Blast the packets at them. But when they don't need it, well, they don't need this high data rate channel. Okay? So a clever thing that's done here is there a set of shared high-speed downlink channels, and then later a high-speed uplink channel that all the users share. So the idea is, if I'm a user in a 3G system, I get a basic channel. Okay? And over that channel, I can say, hey, I want this data. And when the system sees that that's a large amount of data, what does it do? It says, oh, assign this user to this high-speed downlink channel, give them lots of throughput, right? Download the picture, download the video clip, whatever. And now, assign that channel later to another user. Okay, so the result is, by time multiplexing this very high-speed channel between lots of different users, we accomplish the effect that most of the users think, wow, it's really fast, right? Even though it was only for a short period of time they had this very high-speed connection, and sharing it over lots of users makes a whole bunch of users think they have a high-speed connection, even though there's actually, in reality, only one high-speed connection. Okay? And then it became important to introduce the same thing on the uplink when users started saying, oh, click, take the picture, upload it. Right? But after I've uploaded that picture, I don't need the high data rate channel anymore. Right? So click, 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 lots of users happily multiplex this. And there's a very nice thesis project that examines this from several years ago. But today, users can achieve perhaps 5.8 megabits per second. Now, all of you have hopefully seen these small little USB dongles that everyone is, you know, just please take one. And Huawei, I'm sure, is just laughing all the way to the bank because these are wildly adopted. What's the big advantage? Well, they incorporate both of these standards, so the result is you get one of these things, you plug it into your laptop, voila, you think you have broadband wireless service. Right? It just looks like a high-speed TPP network connection. very, very successful. Why was it more successful than getting customers to use these two things just from phones? Well, the problem is from the phone, I just don't have enough screen space to download very much data before I've filled the screen with something that's the maximum my eyes can see on a screen that big, right? But if I have a laptop with a screen that big, I can load a lot more content, right, in numbers of bits to fill up my screen. And similarly in the reverse, for cameras, video clips, etc. So being able to go from a phone to get rid of the keyboard, get rid of the screen, get rid of almost all my costs, and now I just have a radio and a SIM card, and I plug it into my laptop, boom, there's something that can sync and source lots of bits per second. We mentioned 3GPP2 yesterday. It's to evolve the CDMA system developed by Qualcomm, the CDMA 2000 system, and its secretariat is TIA, which is the North American equivalent to ETSI. The 3GPP2 model is sort of interesting because in the mobile, it says not only do we have the mobile equipment, but we can have several different types of mobile terminals. And one of the interesting things that they did was they defined already a clear interface to the vehicle, which 3GPP didn't do. And I think it's part of the legacy of coming out of the CDMA 2000, where Qualcomm made quite a lot of money by integrating their communication systems with vehicles. So this is going to be interesting to watch to see what happens in the future. Can you turn off your phone here? Or set it to quiet mode or something? Thanks.
यार मैं रिकॉर्ड कर रहा हूँ तो मैं इससे इसीलिए कह रहा था कि इससे भेजें मुझे किसी से लेके मैं कर रहा था मैसेज अच्छे रिकॉर्ड कर रहा हूँ वो टीचर मुझे बार बार कह रहा है तुम्हारा फोन बोल रहा है तुम्हारा फोन बोल
mobile switching centers, there are gateways to that, but there are a whole bunch of other things. What are they? Well, it turns out that this whole set of things down here are the 3GPP2 equivalent of the messaging center, the SMSC and the MMSC. This set of things over here are for customer support. They actually spent a lot of time crafting in a very clear model for how to provide really good customer support. They also build a model in for dealing with location, for location-aware services. And since this was heavily driven, unfortunately, by people in the U.S., there's an entire module just for law enforcement, right? Because law enforcement in most countries needs to be able to find out things like where the user is, and be able to get a copy of the traffic that they're communicating. There's a packet data system up here, and there's, not surprising, all of the normal glop over here to deal with circuit switch systems. But basically, you can understand all the same things in the 3GPP architecture very quickly from the other architectures you've seen, even though it's a lot more complex. The number of interfaces went up, right? So it has a very large number of interfaces, a very large number of abbreviations even. So where's the world going after 3GPP and 3GPP2? Well, here's what seems to be emerging, is the all IP network architecture. And here we have a radio network, but the radio network can now be a GRAN with the UM interface, so like a GPS network, a UTRAN, the UMTS terrestrial radio area network with its view interface, and now it's attached no longer to a radio network controller or to an MSC, but in fact it goes directly to an SGSN. So in this model, immediately we know it's all packets, right? Because the only thing that the SGSN deals with is it's a router. It deals with packets. The same sort of core packet network with the same gateway over here, and gateways to other networks. The HHS, which we saw from 3P, so our home location register and visitor location register and authentication are here. And now these two new interesting services. One, the IP multimedia system over here, and the other, a whole bunch of application and service networks. And the idea here is that operators could come along and offer new services, and third parties could come along and say, hey, I want to offer a service and attach it in this way, and they didn't need to worry about all of these pieces. That means I can offer my services to users in 2.5G networks like GSM, GPRS networks, to users in 3G networks, and there's even a proposal that in fact, of course, we can gateway between this to wireless LANs and other packet networks, and voila, services for everybody. All of this infrastructure over here is designed to use SIP, the Session Initiation Protocol. And if you take the Voice over IP course, you can learn more about that. But the key is the fact that it's also packet-oriented. So the result is now we can gateway from this into the PSTN by having devices that simply convert packets into circuit switch calls and circuit switch calls into packetized voice or other multimedia. And we can interact with the signaling system 7 and TCAP signaling to the PSTN to do all of our control. And we can now separately dimension our control signaling from our media channels. So the system scales much, much better than previously. And of course, it's all based on packets. Now, there's one small little problem in this. And that is that, of course, SIP is a protocol that lots and lots of people have implemented. It's widely available. But the model here is that IMS acts like a so-called walled garden. So what's a walled garden? Okay, if you go to countries like Italy, you see these beautiful gardens behind houses. And what do you see around the garden? But a big tall fence, usually with broken pieces of glass cemented onto the top of the wall. So that's going to be very hard to climb over the wall. Okay? So one of the goals of the IMS system was to fence off all of this so that the only way that the user would get these services is through their operator. So just because we have an open standard here doesn't mean that we have to let a user at this handset be able to directly send SIP packets to some other entity elsewhere in the internet. So we like these protocols, but we have to fence them in so that we can keep control. Now, additionally, one of the things that's changing is previously those handsets were programmed at the factory and they never changed. Basically, unless it was broken and you sent it in for repair, the software that was in it when you bought it is the software you had. Now there's a move to say, no, in fact, you can download applets or other new applications and dynamically change what the handset can do, and hence the introduction of so-called MXE, mobile station application execution environment, where you could basically say, okay, it's an old device, it's stuck with WAP, or it supports personal Java, or it supports J2ME, or it supports ECMA, common language infrastructure, blah, blah, blah. Right? It's basically getting more and more programmable. So in the case of Class Mark 4, the idea here is you can download Java application description files and suddenly extend the software that's available in the handset. Okay. Now, of course, from an architectural point of view, this is great, right? Because we increase the flexibility, we can rapidly introduce new services, but there are also some problems about security. Who gets to say what applications are run on the handset? And so there are all sorts of descriptions for which files you can have, which namespaces, which protocols, etc. And some of you may have heard of Android, Google's activity in the Open Handset Alliance. And there the goal is to even be more flexible, let users actually run their own applications in the handset. And part of that, I think, is driven by the fact that operators have seen how much traffic increased when users could attach these little dongles to their laptops and start running all kinds of services. And they didn't have to wait for the Sony Ericssons and the Nokias and Motorola's and so forth to finally put it into a handset. But unfortunately, there's been fighting over, as usual, religious battles, the physical and link layer, all due to political, economic, et cetera, reasons. And so the problem remains there are lots of choices for the physical layer. There are three different choices for the networking layer. But as we've seen, using the idea of internetworking, we can say, okay, fine, these different networks use their own physical and link layers. Somehow we'll deal with the network layers and we'll interconnect them all somehow, probably through IP. One of the things that's been proposed is a gateway location register. So instead of having a home location register, the idea is that in fact we explicitly build a gateway location register, which now does the translation to and from the mobility protocols and location data inside one operator's network to the protocols that are needed by another operator's network. So we can glue different kinds of networks together, but logically treat them as if they were somehow these all IP networks and we don't really care what's inside them. There's been a lot of emphasis on this, particularly to reduce traffic, particularly due to roaming and international roaming. So we don't have to go clear back to the user's home network. We can say, hey, we know they're in Greece right now. They were here last time. Well, let's look in our location register here. And this is true even if they switch between a wireless LAN in Greece to the wide area network in Greece to some other wireless network in Greece. They shouldn't have to go all the way back to their home network in Sweden to figure out where they are for each of those different networks. Okay, so this follows up this discussion we had started a little bit this morning about this problem of do we use DNS-like services or do we do database-like services? And this is yet another push, I think, in the direction of saying we want to be databases. Now, if you want all of these different services, like streaming media, video conferencing, et cetera, then the problem becomes, again, about quality of service. Four classes, conversational, streaming, interactive, and background. Not surprisingly, we saw those before. There's seven different QoS parameters specifying a minimum, maximum, and a guaranteed bit rate, the maximum packet size, reliability, blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, there are major problems with how to actually map those parameters onto the quality of service of different systems. In particular, the problem when you now attach two different systems to each other, and the two systems have chosen different mappings for those QoS parameters. So if I have one user in this network talking to another user in this network, how do I ensure that across the whole path, I provide the quality of service that the two users want and, oh, by the way, that I'm going to charge them for? Right? And that charging is a very important thing because if I give them greater resources so they can have low delay or low loss or high throughput or something like that, I want to get paid for it. And therein lies lots of complexity. Now, if the SIM module was a good idea in GSM, UMTS said, hey, we want the UMTS subscriber identity module, the USIM. Now, if you thought these architectures of the networks were complex, this is just the listing of the 3GPP specifications concerning the USIM. Yes, truly frightening. Because not only do you have USIM, you have a toolkit, you have application toolkits. Ah, now we start to see interpreters and bytecodes now running virtual machines inside this USIM toolkit because people started realizing, hey, I can download applications even to the SIM. Language bindings, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got this extra little processor you're carrying around with, you know, a couple of megabytes of memory, special cryptographic processors, et cetera. And now people are saying, hey, I can reprogram it too, and I can do it on the fly. Not surprisingly, there's been a big battle for what's the operating system that's going to run in the handset. And there have been various contenders for this. And, of course, we know that it's unlikely there's going to be any single winner. In addition, something crept up during the course of second generation mobile networks. And this is the idea of mobile virtual network operators. And these are operators who don't actually have a network. What they have is subscribers. And they simply go to an actual network operator and say, hey, I've got lots of subscribers in your area. I want to buy this many million minutes of call capacity in your network for my subscribers. And one of the first to really do this successfully was Richard Branson's company, Virgin Mobile, who signed up 700,000 customers in their first year. Now just think about it. Okay, he's a nice guy. He's out there saying, hey, wouldn't you like to sign up for Virgin Mobile? And customers weren't asking, well, what kind of network do you have? What are the facilities? They said, yeah, Virgin Mobile sounds like a good idea. I'll sign up. Right? Normally, if you had someone who was selling subscriptions and didn't have a network, you would say, geez, this sounds like fraud. But in fact, it's been very successful because now that they have a large subscriber base, who, of course, can pay for the network deployment, the MVNO targets their particular market. They know who their customers are. Whereas previously, if you were a mobile network operator, who are your customers? Well, it was whoever happens to live in the area that I service, which is a wide variety of customers. Some who be like me, who make maybe one or two calls per year. Okay? I'm not going to make much on those customers. Some are people who live and breathe on their cell phone. I want to make them happy so they can spend even more of their money on my network. But MVNOs could target these different groups. Additionally, Oftel, which is the regulator in the UK, when it examined what could MVNOs offer, and they did a very nice analysis of this, they actually found out that there are big advantages to having MVNOs because they really wanted to take good care of their subscribers, whereas these other companies didn't even know who their subscribers were. And talking to one of the companies just recently, they said, one of the hard problems we have is we have no idea who our customers are. We don't even know, in many cases, how to contact them because they bought prepaid subscriptions. So they have no communication channel, they have no nice profiles from a marketing point of view, they don't know how to market or do advertising or anything to them because they don't know who the customers are. And so they have a major effort nowadays just trying to figure out, gee, there's a customer like me who has two cellular subscriptions, a broadband subscription, an IPTV subscription, and from their current understanding, those are five different customers. Okay, yes, after much struggling, I got both of the mobile subscriptions on the same bill. All of the other things came on different bills because, from their point of view, these are different customers. Whereas MVNO said, hey, we're your company, right? Get your service from me. Whatever your service is, we'll work it out, and I'll provide you that service. And they did that for who they saw as their target customers. And they were wildly successful. And there's actually a guy in the south central part of Sweden who did this not only as an MVNO, but for fixed telephony, IP telephony, IPTV, and cable TV. And he actually pays a major operator for all of the different networks. And the only thing that he has is basically a company name, a company number, and a logo to put on the bills that he sends the customers. And the customers love it. Because he went and studied the demographics of this local district and figured out what sort of offering and how to price it and package it for this group of customers. And they are wild about it. It's just the kind of services they need. Now, a hard problem is, if you're a major operator who has a network, this means you have to interface to the MVNOs, right? It's no longer your subscribers. It's also you have to deal with interacting with this other system to validate registrations and call setups and call terminations and numbering and all of that with somebody else. So that complicates our architectural picture a bit. As I said, 3GPP introduced this IP multimedia system, and 3GPP and 3GPP2 have tried to coordinate it, so at least there will be only one IMS. New services, instant messaging, presence, push to talk over cellular, etc. So in terms of instant messaging and presence, this solves one of the big problems that subscribers had before, right? Can I call this customer now? Are they available? Do they want to be called? If not, then there's no point in my trying to contact them, right? So if I can use presence information, I can say, ah, yes, Susanna's available this afternoon, or I want to go to a movie, and as one of my students said, you know, I like American action movies, and I want to go to the theater with other people who like the same kind of movies, but do I want to work through my whole telephone list of calling everybody to find that out? No, I want to say, hey, is anybody interested? So today, one of the new areas of service, and there have been now at least two, XJobs presented on combining social network data with these systems so that now you can really do something like saying, yes, I want to go bicycling on Saturday. Anyone else want to bicycle from Stockholm to Uppsala? Or go ice skating if the weather stays cold, whatever. Why? Because those are the services that people want to have. It isn't just about calling each other. It isn't about minutes of billing of voice calls. Thus, not surprisingly, there's lots and lots of future services that are being proposed, particularly ones that combine presence and instant messaging, that combine person-to-machine communication. So today, lots of people, and one of the most demanding applications in 3G networks today is gaming. And there are a number of companies. Terraplay is one of the big ones here in Sweden, that produce entire infrastructures which they sell to operators to produce gaming environments. And this is the most demanding services for these networks because, in fact, the delays have to be low. And now companies are introducing automated avatars that you can play against so you don't even have to wait for their other people to be able to, yes, spend your money playing the game. And some of you probably know in things like Second Life, etc., there are companies in the business of making real money by selling you virtual objects or doing virtual work for you. to go and, you know, collect golden pelts or whatever. In addition, there are lots of things happening in terms of smile, which we mentioned earlier, in terms of simultaneous media streams. So, what are the details of IMS? Well, if we look inside that IMS box, we see that there's an interface to the GGSN, because we need to get our packets. And so there's this thing called the proxy call session control function. And its major purpose is to decide who else to send the traffic to. One of the things it communicates with is the HHS to decide should you actually be getting service. If you're a visitor or calling someone in a visit in another network, it may send you through the interrogating call session control function to connect to another IMS network. Or it may send you to the service call session control function to actually give you various other services running on application servers. And there are all kinds of things that people are building on application servers. So I had two students who did an X-Job last year, and they looked at it not in this case for IMS, but connected to an IPTV system, so not just for voice, but for other applications. And the applications they built were things like giving you a word cloud so that you could access, through your IPTV set-top box, Facebook, Twitter, all of these sorts of things, and therefore get suggestions, in many cases, about what kind of film you wanted to watch, and now just using your remote control, say, oh yes, I was interested in this film. Kevin Bacon was in this film with this actress. Okay, who is, oh, what film is she? I want to see that film. Zoom, right? Not that I'm suggesting this is all mindless, but maybe fun. And there are people willing to pay for it. So, of course, how do we provide those kinds of services? Another thing that's happening is something called long-term evolution radio networks, LTE. And this is the thesis that somebody asked me about earlier, yes, is Peter Edstrom. And he looked at the overhead on LTE whenever you're supporting multimedia packets, in particular things like voice over IP packets, where actually the IP data is very small. Because it turns out in LTE that although the links are very, very high speed, 100 megabit per second downlink, 50 megabit per second, potentially with very low latencies, the price that's paid is you only get these high data rates when you're in a good location. Okay, so if you're in a position where you've got great connectivity, boom, we can blast data to you. But it relies on the fact that the users are going to be moving around, so you might be in a bad position, but you won't stay in a bad position forever, hopefully. And as you move to another position, good connectivity, zap, blast lots of bits to you. Oops, bad connectivity again, play it out of the cache. Okay, so really exploiting in real time the variance of the link quality. And this is a fairly interesting area. And I think LTE is supposed to come into Sweden starting here in Stockholm next year, in 2010. So I mentioned Theo Kanter did his dissertation on adaptive personal mobile communication, looking at service architecture and protocol, and he's the one who introduced this term of PIG. And he wants to exploit the fact that if I'm in this network, I'm this position, I know the networks I can hear, okay? And now as I move along, if I approach you, I can give you the data about the network you're about to encounter, right? Because I'm just coming from the place where you're headed, right? And meanwhile, you can tell me about the network and services that are ahead of me, okay? And this idea of being able to prepare in advance means that you can do things like negotiate for services, authenticate yourself, etc., all before you arrive in this new service region. And the major part of his thesis was how do you describe those services? There are also suggestions that there'll be fourth generation networks. In particular, one of the most important things, I believe, is going to be user-deployed base stations. And so Professor Jens Zander and his students have been focusing for a number of years now on what happens when you start putting in very, very small base stations, which aren't planned. The operator isn't spending a man year to decide where to put all of them. What's going to happen? Docomo has been introducing its FOMA system, which is a third generation cellular network, and they're pushing very hard to understand how to integrate FOMA with Wi-Fi or wireless LAN. The same day at the 3G World Congress and Exhibition Hong Kong that they did this in 2004, Nokia showed real-time streaming and video handoffs between two different CDMA access networks using mobile IPv6. So the person who asked about IPv6, it's very obvious that this is going to be an important thing for the future networks. Additionally, there are proposals like IEEE 802.21, and the goal is to enable handover and interoperability between heterogeneous network types, including both 802 and non-802 networks, and 802.11 is the wireless LAN. We've got a variety of proposals for 4G networks in Asia, CJK, China, Japan, Korea, cooperation for beyond 3G, Future, which is one of the Chinese efforts in this area, MITF in Japan, and one of the most successful so far is Wireless Broadband Portable Internet, WIBRO, in Korea. And this has been incredibly successful. Of course, you may have also seen it under another name, WiMAX. So it's the Korean variant of WiMAX. But they pushed it very hard and quite successfully. And we had a visitor from Korea last year who was one of the main drivers in this activity. So if you want, you can take a look at Dongwoo Kim's slides. They're at this URI. You can find a description of it. And it's particularly if you're interested in radio systems, there's some very interesting things that have been done there. There's also a group called the e-mobility platform, driven by this set of companies, an even bigger usual suspects list. And their goal is looking at the 2010 to 2020 horizon, because that's, of course, beyond the immediate term, so that's pre-competitive research that they can do legally together. And they're trying to understand, how do we really provide e-mobility? How do we provide the various e-services that are going to be, the e-government? And as you may know, in Sweden, the goal of having 24-hour-a-day government. I'd be very happy if it wasn't 24 hours a day. If it would just only be, you know, 8 hours a day, maybe that might be a good thing. But if it worked better, the interaction worked better. And so people are trying to understand, how do you do that? And there are more readings about all of these things. Okay, any questions? Okay, if no questions, we'll continue just very briefly talking about wireless local loop. The idea here is a major problem today in networks is the so-called last mile. It's from the point where the switching center is or the high bandwidth networking point to the customer, whether it's in a home, whether it's at the handset, but in the case where it's at home, this is usually called, in the wired case, a local loop, and increasingly people now want to have the wireless local loop. And so this is very popular in areas that don't have a large amount of copper buried in the ground. Or places where it's very expensive to dig in the ground. So I was in Prague a number of years ago on the day when they introduced their first version of this, because the city of Prague is very ancient and very historic, and digging in the street requires an enormous number of permits, because almost any time you dig in the street, yes, you hit historic ruins. And as soon as you hit the historic ruins, you have to stop your work until the archivists and archaeologists come in and examine it. So it's very expensive putting anything in the ground. So what's the solution? where you don't put it in the ground, you use wireless links, and you attach those to your switching function.